It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. 2 weeks now before the NFL draft gets underway, we get perspective from Packers columnist Pete Doherty on where he thinks quarterback Aaron Rodgers will ultimately land. Call in with your take, your questions and forecasts on the Packers roster, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Pete Doherty writes for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin, covered the Packers for 30 years. Pete, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me.
So last week, New York Jets general manager Joe Douglas assures fans that the trade for Aaron Rodgers will happen, saying Rodgers is gonna be here. What is prolonging this trade?
I guess, it's just coming down to, what each side wants. And there's no real hard deadline. The first hard deadline will be probably when the second round of the draft starts a week from tomorrow, because that's probably going to be the pick that gets traded this year as a second-round pick from the Jets. And, as executives in the league always say, deadlines spur action. And so once, as the deadline gets closer and you get right to it, if it's not done before then, that'll kind of force the action. So it's just really hard to imagine the deal not going through. Both teams want and need it to happen. And so they're just, it's kind of a staring contest right now. On the Jets are trying to give up as little as possible, and the Packers are trying to recoup as much as they can for him.
What might trade negotiations be? If you're a fly on the wall, here you have this four-time MVP, 18 seasons in Green Bay. What are they trying to hash out?
So there was a credible report yesterday that the Packers are asking for a second rounder this year and a first rounder next year. And if Rodgers doesn't play next year, because the draft will be in April and the season obviously isn't until September, if Rodgers ends up not playing in 24, then the Packers would give back the Jets something, a draft pick in 25, because they got the first rounder next year. And it sounds like the Jets, according to this report, are the ones, and the owner was concerned when Rodgers said that he was, 80 or 90% leaning towards retirement
90.
before he went into that darkness retreat. Yes. They heard that and they were concerned that he's not going to play in 24, that he might not. And so they don't want to give up that first rounder next year. My guess is somewhere in here, even though it sounds like the owner is the one who's concerned, he's just going to say enough is enough and do the deal. And because that's probably, when I talked to scouts before, early in the offseason about what he might be worth, that was basically the range that a handful of them all gave, was a 2 and a 1. So that's probably what it'll end up being. And it's just a matter of getting the Jets to pull the trigger.
Why does Rodgers want to go to the Jets?
He knows the Packers don't, they want to move on to Jordan Love. And the Jets have a really good roster. Packers played them last year. Packers lost to them at Lambeau. The Jets have a really good young defense. They have some good young talent on offense. They've been bad for quite a while, so they've been picking really high in the draft for a bunch of years, and that talent's starting to accrue. They just don't have a ready-made quarterback right now, and that's what held them back last year. And I think they finished, right around 500, just, maybe a little under. And they think Rodgers is the guy who can get them over the hump. Their owner's 75, and he's owned the team for 20-plus years, and he really badly wants to win a Super Bowl. And I think Rodgers, a lot of good quarterbacks in that league, so it's a tough road, but I think Rodgers thinks they have a really good team and a chance to do it. He probably finds going to the big media market and the chance to market himself and get even more endorsements than he already has. Maybe he finds that attractive too.
We're talking with Pete Doherty. He's a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette. As we look at the future of Aaron Rodgers and what will become of him and the Packers, you can join in with your predictions, your questions, your concerns as a Packers fan. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I want to circle around to that retirement thing because it seems like Tom Brady made a clean break this time around so far. I mean, if Rodgers retired, would he change his mind? Or if he doesn't retire, like how sticky is this decision, do you think, for Rodgers?
Yeah, well, as we've seen, it's, you know, for a lot of guys, it's not that sticky. So I'm really, really skeptical that, one, he was 90% going to retire. Maybe he had convinced himself of that. But deep down, I'm just highly, highly skeptical that retirement was really on the table. He has a guaranteed contract this year for $59 million, which means all he has to do is show up and play. And whoever has his contract, which is the Packers right now, they have to pay him $59 million. They cannot cut him. They can cut him, but they still have to pay him the $59 million. Mm-hmm. I find it hard to believe anybody is going to walk away. I mean, that's just a ridiculous amount of money. And I'm sure he has post-playing ambitions, and some of those might require having a lot, like, you know, possibly owning a, you know, being part of an ownership group in a pro sports team. That takes a lot of capital to do that. And where else can you make $59 million with, you know, about eight months of work?
That's really interesting. As looking at the road ahead and what that future looks like, you know, there have been rumors that other teams like the 49ers may try to trade for Rodgers. Is there any credible evidence there?
There's no credible evidence that, you know, any talks with the 49ers were ever serious. And the Packers might be reluctant to trade him to a team in the NFC because theoretically, you know, that team could be in the way of them getting to the Super Bowl themselves. Mm. You know, so I think the most recent, they did inquire about him last year, last February, when it looked like he was maybe going to ask to be traded. But I haven't seen anything credible that there's been any serious negotiations between the two. Now, if this thing, for whatever crazy reason, falls apart and doesn't get done before the draft, and the 49ers, you know, don't feel great about their quarterback situation after the draft still, then, I mean, you never know. But I still find it really hard to believe that it's going to come to that. And I still think the deal, it's hard to fathom the deal not getting done sometime between now and 2 weeks from Friday.
There have been some rumblings about Rodgers trying to recruit players to the New York Jets. What do you see happening there?
Well, they signed Alan Lazard, who was, you know, a receiver with the Packers last year. There's been reports that they might have some interest in Randall Cobb, who was obviously a teammate for years with the Packers. And it's not just teammates. I mean, they hired Nathaniel Hackett as their offensive coordinator earlier in the offseason. He had been Rodgers' offensive coordinator here in Green Bay for several years, and then Denver's head coach for a season last year before he got fired. And that sure looks like a move that the Jets did, thinking that they were going to make pretty hard, go after Rodgers pretty hard this offseason. So it's not just players. It's
some familiar company. Yes, a familiar coaching company around Rodgers. Ahead of the NFL draft and trade talks around the league, we look at timing, potential outcomes. We've got veteran Packers columnist Pete Doherty here. Join in with your questions, how you view the destiny of Aaron Rodgers, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been nearly a month now since Aaron Rodgers made his intentions clear about wanting to play for the New York Jets. What does the future hold for Rodgers and the Packers? Call in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have longtime Packers columnist Pete Doherty with us. Let's take a call now. Pat is here from Three Lakes. Hi, Pat. What would you like to share?
Yeah, I've got a question and a comment. My question is, Aaron Rodgers was MVP 2 years ago, and last year he had a pretty down year. I've heard he had some pretty serious injuries last year, and he played through them. That's my first question. My comment is that Green Bay Packer fans have been fortunate in the last 30 years to have two of the greatest quarterbacks that ever played the game. And we got spoiled, and we criticized them, and we made them like they were not worthy of being at Green Bay. And I just want to say that I'm really fortunate because I was there in the 60s and went to a lot of the games when we were really good. Then the 70s and 80s when we really fell apart. Then 90s and the teens when we really came back again. And I think that Green Bay Packer fans should, you know, look back at that period of time and say, geez, we were fortunate. Anyway, that's my comment and my question.
Pat, thank you. And for that whirlwind tour through history, Pete Doherty, what do you make of it?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of good points there. So Rodgers did have a broken thumb. He broke it in their game on the last play of their game in London, which was, I think, their fifth or sixth game of the season. And he did play through it, just as Favre did with a similar injury in 99. And you suspect it affected a throw here or there. I will say, even before he broke it, though, he wasn't playing that great. He had played a poor second half in that game with where they went into halftime with the lead and lost it. So I wouldn't attribute all of his play last year to the injury. He did also have a broken rib about halfway through the season or a little farther. And that, you know, would probably bothered him for just judging by the watching him move around for 2 or 3 weeks, but that healed up by the end of the season. So was it a factor? Sure. But I don't think it completely explains, you know, I think some of his skills are diminishing. It's just his ability. What always set him apart was his ability to break the pocket when the play was breaking down and to throw these great, really accurate throws on the move. And he just, you know, it's Father Time is undefeated and all that. And at 39, he doesn't make those plays on command. He still has his moments, but he doesn't make those plays on command like he did 5 years before, let alone 10 years before. So I think that's a factor in his play also. And, you know, it's obvious. I mean, it's the Packers fans, of course, are spoiled. A lot of Packers fans don't know what life is like when you don't have a quarterback. 30 years of this of Hall of Fame play is extraordinary and really, really unusual in the NFL. And, you know, it can take a lot. I mean, you know, maybe Jordan Love will be the answer, but it could take 20 years to find a quarterback or more. I mean, arguably the Chicago Bears have been looking for a real quarterback since Sid Luckman. And I think he retired in like 1951.
What might the reaction to Jordan Love be from diehard Packers fans who've been there, like Pat, through the generations, through the decades, and, you know, the NFL at large? What might we expect?
Well, I'm sure, you know, fans will be probably a lot like the team is, you know, excited to see this guy play and see what he's like. But if things go poorly, I mean, things will turn fast. Now, he could end up being a really, really good player, and chances are the Packers are still going to be in for a rough season this year. In Rodgers' first season as a starter, which, like Love, was his fourth season in the league. This will be Love's fourth season. The Packers only went 6-10. Now, Rodgers played well enough. We're halfway through the season. They committed to him. They extended his contract, gave him a big raise, and said, "You're the guy," and they felt good enough about him to do that. But they still only won 6 games that season. So chances are really good that regardless of how good Love is, the Packers are in for a rough season. And obviously, you know, everybody, me, everybody who follows the team, people who work for the team, they're all going to be scrutinizing this guy's play to try to figure out if he's good enough to be the guy or if next year at this time, you know, they're in the hunt for another quarterback.
Can you do any comparing or contrasting between the transition and handoff from Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers to what you're seeing now with Rodgers and Love?
Yeah, the comparisons are there for sure. I mean, it's just really unusual for one, for a guy to be drafted in the first round and to not play pretty early in his career. It's even fairly rare to go a full season without playing. But both of these guys sat for three full seasons, which is really unusual. So that's one thing. Another is that Favre got traded to the Jets, and that's where Rodgers is going to be going. The difference from what I can tell is there's a huge difference in fan sentiment. When Favre wanted to come back in 2008 after he had retired in March, and then he wanted to come back in July, and the Packers didn't want him back, that really split the fan base because, you know, as we talked earlier, they had gone 25 years without winning anything, and this is the guy who resurrected the franchise more than any other one single person. And he was a fan favorite, and people just loved him, and it really split the fan base. There was a lot of sentiment, angry as can be, at the Packers for trading him, and if he wanted to come back, not taking him. Just kind of informally, since this season ended, you know, I'll run into friends and acquaintances, you know, at the gym or the grocery store, or just out and about, and we'll, you know, small talk for a couple minutes. And then I must have talked to at least 30 people, and I'd say, so trade them or keep them. And of course they knew what I was talking about, and you could see the wheel spinning. And I would say 80 to 90% of them said trade them. So I think the blowback for actually making this move in the off season, there's just zero blowback. I think the majority of Packers fans are for it. Now the sentiment can turn, if Love is bad and he's not going to be good enough, then the sentiment will turn against the franchise, but they're not going to be in the foxhole like they were back in 08 when it was just, that was a brutal experience, I think, for the people at the top of the chain over at the Packers. And they are not in for that in trading Rodgers this go round.
I like the idea of a Pete Doherty poll, maybe to formalize that a bit. Talking with the longtime Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette, you can call in about a post-Aaron Rodgers era for the Pack, 800-642-1234. So Jason from Madison, and, you know, just wants to circle around again to the trade. Why don't the Packers wait until the draft to trade, and won't they get a better deal, Jason asks, and wouldn't that help both teams?
So it could end up being they do wait to the draft. If he was thinking wait after the draft, if they do the trade in June, it would help their salary cap this year but make it worse in the future. Mm-hmm. So I think they want to just get the salary cap hit over with now and be free and clear of him counting on their cap in the future. I don't think we're going to do all this waiting, and I think the deal's going to end up being what it would have been if the Jets had pulled the trigger the day. It's going to be for that second round pick this year and a first round pick next year, with the Packers happen to give something back if Rodgers ends up not playing in 24. I would think the Jets, you know, they don't have a big incentive to get it done early, but the offseason program starts in a few days. And because he's going to a new team, I would think they would want him there for all of that, to meet his teammates, to start doing on-field drill work in a few weeks. I would think they'd want him on board for all that stuff, to get used to his new receivers and all that. So they have incentive to want to get it done. The Packers want to get it done before the draft so they can get that pick this year. I don't think the compensation is going to change between now and the draft. And my guess is Woody Johnson's going to, the Jets owner, is going to say, we need to get this done. Let's just do it. And it'll get done, but it might not be until, you know, 2 weeks from tomorrow, right before the second round starts.
As we wrap up here, how will the history books treat the Packers era, Rodgers Packers era? I mean, where does Rodgers rank into this history of Green Bay quarterbacks?
Yeah, it's a long history with a lot of, you know, championships and winning football, the most championships in league history. And he and Favre are the two best players that come through this franchise, and the two best, most talented quarterbacks. The top of it, Rodgers has had his share of controversy with, you know, not with essentially lying about whether he'd been vaccinated and all of that. But the top line is he won this team a lot of football games. He helped secure the franchise's financial future because they were able to win a title and sell stock and refurbish the stadium and make money off that and build Title Town, which is a source of income for the future.
There's a legacy. Well, Pete, we'll end it there. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Pete Doherty, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Covered the Packers since 1993. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As gas-powered vehicle technology begins to fade into the past, like a dying battery, we explore this transition period to electric vehicles and what to learn from car museum relics. Call in with questions and comments about cars, past, present, and future, how you view this evolution. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Don Bondas is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum in Hartford, northwest of Milwaukee. Don, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
Well, yesterday we saw the EPA proposing its strictest vehicle emission rules to date in an effort to speed up electrification. Historically, how effective are government regulations at influencing the car industry's trajectory?
They've definitely had an influence. And as far as electric vehicles go, Norway is a country that has seen enormous jumps in the number of electric vehicles there. In 2022, 4 out of 5 cars there were purchased were electric vehicles. And there were a number of government incentives, no road tax, tolls, public parking fees. So at least in Norway, the government regulations were definitely having an effect. It's uncertain what effect that might have in the future here, though.
Right, because the Biden administration now wants most new cars to be electric by 2032. How might this compare to any time in history when a technology adoption was so heavily pushed by the federal government? Can you think of any parallels?
I can't think of any where the government was pushing it, but in the earliest days of the automobile, about the turn of the century, you know, about 1900, late 1890s, very early 1900s, the split between gas, steam, and electric vehicles was not exactly equal, but very close. And at that point, gasoline won out. And part of it was just the practicality of it. Electric vehicles at that time had a much shorter range, so they could only go about 30 or 40 miles in some of those earliest years. And you had to stop and recharge, and there weren't other places where you could recharge. You were probably, you know, doing that primarily in cities. But the gas-powered vehicles, and the same thing, you had to stop for water with a steam-powered vehicle. So in that early kind of tug of three-way, you know, three different directions, the gasoline vehicles won out.
Imagine if electric had won out and where we'd be today.
Right, but part of it, even then as now, part of it is, I think, the infrastructure. You know, even today, the electric vehicles in many cases have a shorter range yet, and when you get farther west and in more rural areas, there are fewer opportunities for recharging. And I think, you know, that is changing rapidly, but it's still a factor.
What have you seen in terms of the evolution of seatbelts and, you know, more recently backup cameras and some of these real game changers for vehicles?
Well, and seatbelts are one of those things that's interesting. When seatbelts were first introduced, in the late 1940s, there was kind of some pushback because when they were put in, like with Nash, that's a Wisconsin, was a Wisconsin auto manufacturer. And when seatbelts were put in vehicles, they were viewed as, oh, well, your vehicle is unsafe. So then seatbelts were taken out. Of course, they came back fairly rapidly. But it's just, it's interesting how the perspective changes on that.
You know, would the proposed regulations that we're seeing now essentially spell the end of the internal combustion engine? I'm wondering how much of a pivot point are we here in the next chapter of vehicles?
I think it is a significant point, but I don't know that it would be the absolute end of the internal combustion engine. I think that especially, like I mentioned before, with more rural areas and going points west, I think hybrids could be very attractive. So if you are traveling in those remote areas, you like electric primarily, but you have that the gasoline backup. But yeah, I don't think it's in because I think there's always going to be people who like the gasoline engines. I always think there's going to be, you know, part of the market who likes that.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the evolution of automobiles with Don Bondas, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum. You can join in this car conversation at 800-642-1234. Your questions and your comments, they're welcome. Email ideas at WPR.org. Don, last month, the parent companies, Stellantis and General Motors, they both said they're discontinuing their respective Dodge Challenger and Chevy Camaro gas-powered muscle car lines. And American muscle cars have really defined an era of car manufacturing. What do you think is the significance of the end of the rumble car?
Well, I think it is a sign of the times where, you know, cars are, you know, everything's going electric, whether it's pickups, whether it's cars. So I think it is a sign of the times, but when you look back, it says it's the end now. They might reintroduce something like that 10 or 20 years in the future. I'm not sure, but you've seen other manufacturers where they will stop making a certain vehicle. Ford quit making their Taurus and almost immediately brought it back. They quit making the Ranger and they've brought that back. So it's probably the end for now, but I don't know that it's necessarily the end forever.
Don't ever shut the door on those right. on those models, especially those ones that have such a history. You know, what can we learn about the design and styling and the choices that were made long ago by these automakers that seem to pop up in cars today, or maybe that influence the look and feel of modern vehicles?
It is true. It's interesting to take a step back and look at how the pendulum swings back and forth or things come back into style. And that's everything. A lot of people think that front wheel drive is something that came about in the late 20th century, and it was much earlier. The late 1920s, you were seeing some of the earliest front-wheel drive vehicles. The Cord L29 was one. The Ruxton was another one. And the Kissel Motor Car Company, and the Kissel car was made here in Hartford for 25 years, but they were involved in that front-wheel drive Ruxton. And when they were introduced, it was a horrible time. It was the with right around the time of the stock market crash. So the timing couldn't have been much worse to introduce a higher-end vehicle like that. But then the Tornado came along in the late 60s, and but the front wheel drive has more a deeper history than what a lot of people think. And even colors will come and go. You look at the late 1920s, early 1930s, tans were a very in color. And if you look a little farther forward, the late 1980s, the early 1990s, those tans were also in style. And currently, you see a lot of black, silvers, grays, whites. Those have been very much in style for a while. So you see those things come and go. But you also see it in just the overall styling. The more modern Camaros and Mustangs definitely have throwbacks to their late 60s, early 1970s body styles. Years ago, you saw the PT Cruiser, and that definitely had retro styling. So you do see things come back in a different format.
I'm just envisioning, you know, the fashion runway with vehicles going down it. You know, what about the stick shift? CarMax says fewer than 3% of vehicle sales were manual transmission. That was back in 2020. A nearly 90% drop in popularity since the 90s. Is it the end of the stick shift?
I don't think so with that one. And I know if with pickups, there is a desire for people who want to buy a manual transmission, and the major manufacturers have quit doing it because the demand is, you know, they think the demand is not there, but there are people out there who would purchase a manual if they could, you know, if they could. So I'm not sure, but it's definitely something that's changed. It seems like the manual transmissions are primarily in sports cars now.
You talked about the batteries and the gasoline, the steam. What other materials have automakers used to power cars over the generations?
Well, those are the primary ones that have been used to just for regular passenger vehicles, that it was the gasoline, the steam, and the electric were the main ways.
Don Bondas leads the Wisconsin Automotive Museum as we explore historically significant vehicles of the past, especially in Wisconsin, how they inform modern cars on the roads today and this transition to electric. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the rapid growth in EV sales and car companies racing to ramp up their models and offerings, we ask a car museum what we should make of this moment. Call in with your questions and comments about the evolution of vehicles, how you see it, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Don Bondas is here, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum in Hartford. Don, let's shine a light here on Kissel for a moment. Second longest lasting local car manufacturer, made luxury automobiles in your museum's hometown of Hartford for 25 years. How did Kissel make its mark on the auto industry?
Well, from the start, Kissel was in the game to make a higher quality automobile. And that's what they did. Henry Ford, for instance, was in it to build a car for the masses, but Kissel was in it to make that higher quality vehicle and to be known for their durability and styling. Kissel was well known for winning hill climb contests in the early years. And it was one of those cars of the stars. There were a lot of well-known names of the day who were driving a Kissel. It was William Randolph Hearst, Amelia Earhart, Mary Pickford. So, like I said, some pretty big names. And Kissel even experimented with an electric vehicle. And it's kind of interesting. We don't have a lot of evidence. There was one article published in about 1909 where they indicated they were going to be making an electric vehicle. And there's one photo that we have from the archives that shows essentially a chassis with a lot of batteries on it and an employee out in front of the factory building. The electric vehicles did not come to pass, but Kissel also had announced around the same time that they would begin building trucks, and they did start building trucks. So I think that perhaps they realized they had bitten off more than they could chew. And it's also interesting is the Kissel brothers who were starting the automotive company, Will and George, the first car they purchased was actually a steam car. And they got the bug by buying that first steam car and selling some first steam cars. But then when they were making a car of their own, it wound up being a gas-powered vehicle.
What is your favorite Kissel on display at the museum, I wonder, and why does it speak to you?
Oh, everybody, most people go for the gold bug, the mm-hmm. Speedster that was one of those cars of the stars. But I really like some of the mid-1920s Kissels with some of their styling, because they had a triple body stripe and they had a louver stripe. And the artillery wheels are one of those elements that you've seen that styling come back in some trucks where it almost looks like it's a wood spoked wheel. And with cars of that time, you didn't see the exposed wood. Today, people, you know, always love seeing the wood graining, and you didn't see that at that time. There wasn't the treated lumber. So paint was a protectant, and it was also a styling opportunity. So those mid-1920s Kissels would have, you know, a specific wheel color and a wheel stripe. And we have a couple of those here at the museum that are so correctly detailed. I think it's really interesting, really nice to see.
Super elegant. I always wonder what's in the trunk of antique cars. Like, what did they value carrying around back then versus what we carry with us now? You know, was it a spare tire and jack? Were there other tools? What do you know about trunks?
There could be tools. Sometimes there were toolboxes that were mounted right on the running boards. Depending on the style of the car, sometimes the spare tires were mounted as a side mount up close to the front of the car. Sometimes they were mounted on the rear. It might be one, it might be two. But an actual trunk, in a lot of cases, was like how we use suitcases today. That, you know, if you were traveling, it would be what you were taking to go somewhere for a week. So it was a lot of times probably personal items like that. And the trunks were removable on those earliest cars. So you could just pick it up and take it off like a you know, 19th century traveling trunk. And we've got examples of that here at the museum too.
Oh, wow. Was it more than the Great Depression that led to the demise of Kissel?
It was essentially the Great Depression.
Okay.
That led to it. It was a high-end car. You know, people were cutting back, and there were names far bigger than Kissel with car manufacturers who did not make it out of the 1930s. And Auburn, Cord, and Duesenberg are three of those big names that a lot of people recognize. None of those companies made it out of the 1930s either.
How much of the Kissel cars were assembled right there in Hartford? I mean, what came at all pre-assembled for these people putting them together?
The Kissel prided itself on, at times, you know, they were saying over 90% of the vehicle was produced in Hartford. So they had the body department, the paint department, upholstery. At the very beginning, they were using a different engine, but for the majority of the company's run, they were making their own engine. At the very end, they were modifying a Lycoming engine, but it was built here in Hartford. It was a custom-built car, and that meant you could get any color that you wanted, which meant that you could make some questionable choices. We have documentation that someone wanted and got a pistachio and lilac Kissel, the purple and green Kissel. And the James Montgomery Flagg, the illustrator who did the Uncle Sam illustration with I Want You for the U.S. Army, had several Kissels in succession. And there was one of his Speedsters. We have a letter indicating what he wanted it to look like. And the letter says that he sent a sketch along. Would love to have that sketch, but unfortunately we don't have it. But the car that he wanted was an ivory body with fuchsia fenders and a green interior.
That will take some second looks there as it drives by.
I think he was probably noticed.
But I'm sure, I mean, you know, the company would make them because that certainly was help keeping them afloat. It's what the customer wanted.
Right. And that's where they wanted to be known as a custom built car. And they were doing the whatever color you wanted for an additional fee right from the start. There were standard colors. And if you deviated from the standard colors, that's where the additional fee came in. But there were, like it was mentioning before, there were color trends, you know, in the earliest part of the century, just like there are now. In the earlier years of automobiles, the dark Brewster greens were an in color. And that was whether it was a Kissel, whether it was a Nash, you know, whatever the, you know, whoever the manufacturer was, the dark blues as well. But there were a lot of bright colors. Vermilion was one that was used even in the 19 teens, and that's sort of a scarlety orange red. So the photos were primarily black and white, but it wasn't the cars that were all black. That's a misconception.
Don Bondas, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum, as we tour through the evolution of automobiles and how they speak to cars today at this point with electrification. 800-642-1234. Turning to Tesla here, formed less than 20 years ago, currently the most valuable car company in the world. How do the popular cars of an era reflect that period in history as you talk about all these flamboyant colors?
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if, you know, if the color, it seems like the colors are starting to come back. And Tesla is, I think they, you know, they are the most successful with electric vehicles. And it'll be interesting to see if that continues to be the case moving forward. There was a recent story that came out about Ford not being profitable with their electric vehicles currently, but they anticipate being profitable within the next few years.
And Ford, having such a long history, having built cars for over 100 years, you'd think they can figure it out.
Yes, and I think it sounds like, from what I've read, it sounds like they do have it figured out and that they will get there in the near future.
Don, thank you so much for joining us and taking us on this tour through history. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been fun.
Don Bondas is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum that is in Hartford, northwest of Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.